Okay. So today is what Bhante Vimaramsi would call the second day blues. You are now getting in touch with the hindrances, most probably sloth and torpor, dullness of mind, restlessness, doubt, maybe some craving, maybe some aversion. So today we're going to be discussing, how do you deal with these teachers, with these friends of ours? And I'm going to be reading from a sutta that is from the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya 107. It's called Ganaka Moglana Sutta, to Ganaka Moglana. And this sutta actually is it's a summary of the entire path from beginning to end. So it will give you a good idea of what it is you're going to be doing for these days in the retreat. So Ganaka Moglana is different from Moglana, Maha Moglana, that we know of, who is one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, the other being Sariputta. Ganaka Moglana means Moglana, the accountant. Ganaka, to count. So I will begin. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the Eastern Park, in the palace of Megara's mother. Then the Brahmin Ganaka Moglana went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gautama, in this palace of Megara's mother, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. That is, down to the last step of the staircase. Among these Brahmins, too, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. That is, in study. Among archers, too, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. That is, in archery. And also among accountants like us, who earn our living by accountancy, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. That is, in computation. For when we get an apprentice, first we make him count 1 1, 2 2s, 3 3s, 4 4s, 5 5s, 6 6s, 7 7s, 8 8s, 9 9s, 10 10s, and we make him count 102. Now, is it also possible, Master Gautama, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline? It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as, Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit, and afterwards trains him further. So when the Tathagat obtains a person to be tamed, he first disciplines him thus. Come, Bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha. Be perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. So here the Buddha is describing what he would do first if somebody were to be introduced to the Dhamma and were to then take higher ordination as a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni. And so there he would tell them to follow the Patimokkha. In the case of bhikkhus, they have 227 precepts. In the case of bhikkhunis, they have 311 precepts. Here you guys are following 5 or 8 precepts. Pretty simple. Pretty easy to follow for 10 days. So the precepts, sila, that's the foundation of the practice. Get your conduct in order and everything else will fall into place. Dependent upon sila, you have a mind that is ripe for samadhi. And then dependent upon that, your mind can experience punya. That is to say, when you have right conduct, when you follow the precepts, your mind becomes calm and collected naturally. And because your mind becomes calm and collected naturally, it then experiences insights into the nature of reality, into the nature of existence, into the nature of what is self and what is not self, and so on and so forth. So let's say we talk about the 5 basic precepts. There is another reason why we should follow the precepts, and that is to understand how to deal with hindrances. Later on in this talk, I will explain the interconnection between keeping the precepts and the 5 hindrances that you will deal with and you have been dealing with in your meditation. Just to review, what are the 5 precepts? The first precept is to abstain from killing and harming living beings. The second precept is to abstain from taking what is not given. The third precept is to abstain from sexual and sensual misconduct. The fourth precept is to abstain from false speech, gossip, slander, and so on. And the fifth precept is to abstain from indulging in intoxicants that dull the mind. And so he says, when Brahman, the bhikkhu, is virtuous and seeing fear in the slightest fault, trains by undertaking the training precepts, then the Tathagat disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, guard the doors of your sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the eye faculty. Undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, do not grasp at their signs and features, since if you were to leave these sense faculties unguarded, evil, unwholesome states might invade you. Practice the way of their restraint. Guard the sense faculties. Undertake the restraint of the sense faculties. When we talk about restraint, that comes from the word samvara. Now, restraint here sometimes can give the connotation that we need to control our senses. But there is no controller here. You cannot control what it is that you see, what it is that you hear in that moment. But what you can deal with are your reactions to what it is that you're experiencing. As we'll get deeper into this, you'll realize that you can't actually 6R a vedana. You cannot 6R a feeling away. But in relation to that feeling, what is that reaction that you have? Is it rooted in covetousness and grief, in evil, unwholesome states? In other words, the 5 hindrances, in greed, in hatred, in delusion, in craving, aversion, doubt, restlessness, sloth, and torpor. So, how do you deal with the sense faculties? How do you restrain them? Not in terms of controlling them. You deal with them in understanding how they arise and how they pass away. And that is dependent upon clarity of mind. And you gain that clarity of mind every time you use the six R's. Right now, you hear the dogs barking. Where is your attention? Is it on the dogs barking? Are you thinking about that? Or are you listening to this talk? Pay attention to where your mind goes in relation to the sense faculties and in relation to the mind itself, because the mind has a tendency to get carried away with itself through its many thoughts. So the way to restrain them is through right effort. And that right effort is made up of the fourfold right efforts that we talked about yesterday. Preventing unarisen, unwholesome states from arising, then abandoning the arisen, unwholesome states, generating wholesome states of mind, and maintaining those wholesome states of mind. Every time you use the six R's, you are fulfilling these right efforts. When you recognize that there is a distraction, when you recognize your reaction in relation to that distraction, now this is what's key to understand. You're not six R-ing the hindrance away. You're six R-ing your reaction to the hindrance. The hindrance that arises, whether that's craving, whether that's aversion, whether that's doubt, whether that's sloth and torpor, whether that's restlessness, you can't control whether that comes or not. It arises because of certain causes and conditions, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But when they arise, you can't push them away. You can try your best to push them away and you suppress them. Maybe you're successful for some time. But just like when you would take a beach ball and submerge it underwater and you let go of it, it bounces right back up. The same way, when you suppress the hindrances, they will arise in full flurry. So when you recognize that you are distracted, you immediately prevent any unarisen, unwholesome states from further arising. Because it's your lack of attention that is fueling the arising of these unwholesome states. And as soon as you recognize that whole momentum that was going to arise stops right there. When you release your attention from that distraction, bringing it back to the mind and body, you are abandoning the already arisen unwholesome state of mind. Because now you have seen it and you've let go of it and you're here now in the present moment, anchored by your mind and body. When you relax, you also further let go of any of that tightness and tension associated with the craving, associated with the identification with that hindrance. When you come back to your smile, you generate a wholesome state of mind. And then when you return back to your object of meditation, you keep that wholesome state of mind going. And in this way, you fulfill the four right efforts. So when you want to restrain the sense faculties, it's not about controlling them. Sure, you can close your eyes and stop the field of vision. Sure, you can put your fingers in your ears and prevent most of the sound from coming in. Sure, you can close your nostrils and prevent any kind of smells from coming in. But I don't think that's what the Buddha talked about when he said controlling sense faculties. It is your mind and how you respond in relation to their experiences. So if you see that your mind is getting carried away by them, then what do? You six R. You recognize the distraction, release the attention from that distraction, relax the tightness and tension, Come back to the smile. Be aware if you're smiling or not. If you're smiling, good. If you're not, bring back the smile. Come back to your object of meditation and continue. And repeat whenever you get distracted again. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, guards the doors of his senses or sense faculties, then the Tathagat disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, be moderate in eating. Reflecting wisely, you should take food neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life, considering, thus I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. Moderation in eating. So some of you are taking the 5 precepts, some of you are taking the 8 precepts. So that's up to you, whatever it is that you're doing in terms of your food. The whole point about moderation in eating is understanding where your mind is in relation to that food. When you stand in line to get your food, where is your mind? Is it with its object of meditation? Is it with loving kindness? Is it with compassion? Is it radiating? What is it doing? When you take the food into your plate, where is your mind? When you walk back to the dining table, where is your mind? When you take that first morsel, where is your mind? By accepting everything with loving kindness, it becomes that much more enjoyable. And so naturally, you will be moderate in your consumption of food. Moderation in eating can also be understood as moderation of general consumption. Now, obviously, in the retreat setting, you're not really bombarded with any kind of social media, unless you're hiding a second phone somewhere. Hopefully, you're not doing that. But you're not being bombarded with social media and all of these, you know, streaming things like Netflix and Hotstar and Amazon Prime and all of these things. That kind of consumption is also important, right? There is food for the body. There's food for the eyes and the ears and the nose and the mind. So pay attention to what it is that you're consuming. What is the quality of food, not just for the body, but for the mind and the other sense spaces? What is the quality of food that you're consuming? And how much are you consuming? Some people spend their whole day watching Netflix, right? Binging on the latest season of whatever new show is there. If you've done it, you'll see how you feel, right? Maybe you catch the latest thriller novel and you decide to read it in one sitting. Or you watch the latest whatever it is on TV, right? And you watch it all in one sitting. How does your mind feel after doing that? Pretty dull. Tired. Sometimes you could even feel irritation. I just wasted all my time doing this. I could have done something better. So moderation in general consumption. This is also to be mindful of. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, is moderate in eating, then the Tathagat disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, be devoted to wakefulness. During the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, you should lie down on the right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in your mind the time for rising. After rising in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, Purify your mind of obstructive states. So the general instruction here is about wakefulness. Obviously, everybody has their own sleep pattern, their own sleep schedule. You have to see what works for you. Some people have night shifts. Some people have morning shifts. Some people have evening shifts, whatever it might be. Adapt accordingly. Make sure you have enough sleep. I encourage naps on this retreat. So if you feel tired and you're not able to deal with the sloth and torpor, take a 15-minute nap, not more than 20 minutes. If you take more than 20 minutes, then your mind starts to get into other cycles of sleep, and you will feel groggy after that. So 15 to 20 minutes at most. So notice what the Buddha says here. He says, walking back and forth and sitting, he purifies his mind of obstructive states. Purifies the mind of obstructive states. What are obstructive states? Hindrances. How do you purify your mind of obstructive states? The six R's. So, while walking back and forth, where is your mind? What are you doing with your mind? Are you staying with the feeling of loving kindness? Are you staying with your spiritual friend? If you're radiating, are you staying with radiating whatever Brahmavihara it might be? When you're sitting, where is your mind? This is true wakefulness, to be able to recognize where your mind is. This is that metacognition that I mentioned yesterday. And then it also says, while he sleeps, before he sleeps, he notes the time for rising. This is also something I instructed yesterday, suggested that you do. And you can find out for yourself how successful you were. Eventually, you will be able to meet every time you determine that I will wake up at this particular time. You'll do it. You'll eventually say, I'll sleep for 15 minutes. I'll take a nap for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And right at the 15 or 20 minute mark, your eyes open up. That's because your mind becomes more and more purified. Your intentions become more and more purified and are more effective in their realization. So the wakefulness here is to be aware of where your mind is at all times. Eventually, at some point, it will be so wakeful that you'll be able to understand where your mind is, even in the stages of sleep. But that is dependent upon consistent and constant practice. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, is devoted to wakefulness, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Act in full awareness when flexing and extending your limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl. Act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting. Act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Act in full awareness. This word, or this phrase, full awareness, it comes from the word sampajanya. That means clear comprehension. Now, there are levels to this clear comprehension. In the suttas, the Buddha talks about clear comprehension as being aware of the three characteristics of existence. That does not mean that you have to continue to say in your mind, this is impermanent, this is suffering, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. No, that's not what you do. You teach yourself by meditating. Now, that full awareness has different levels. At the very basic level, that full awareness is a full awareness of your object of meditation. which then leads to the full awareness of the insights of the three characteristics of seeing anicca or impermanence, of seeing dukkha or suffering, of seeing anatta or what is not self. And then that leads to the ultimate insight of understanding dependent origination. So it starts with the full awareness of your object of meditation, whether that's metta to yourself or to your friend, or whether that's the Brahmaviharas that you're radiating, wherever you are in your progress and practice. The reason why that leads to the understanding of the three characteristics and then the understanding of dependent origination is because every time you recognize that you are no longer on your object of meditation, you realize the impermanence of that object. You realize that there is suffering in not being with that object. You realize that you have no control over that, and therefore you understand the not-self nature. And later, bit by bit, you understand that everything has a cause and condition, and everything that is conditionally arisen, dependently arisen, is impermanent and therefore liable to cause suffering and therefore not to be seen as me, mine, or myself. This will happen as you progress in your practice, but it's not through a process of analysis and reflection. It is a process through direct knowledge and experience for oneself. So I'm emphasizing again, that starts with the full awareness of your object of meditation. And that is dependent upon how well-tuned your attention is. Whether you have yoniso manasikara or you have ayoniso manasikara. Proper attention or improper attention. Or using the language of that book, Mind Without Craving, attention rooted in reality, meaning aware of what is present right now. And that is dependent upon you being able to use the six R's whenever you recognize that you are distracted. And that is also dependent upon you making sure that you do not become attached to your object of meditation. Full awareness, not just the awareness of the object of meditation, but having that orbital awareness, right? What did you call that? Flexible?
Flexible attention.
Flexible attention. You want to just elaborate on what that is?
There's kind of a spectrum of attention. So you can think about at the most focused end, we'll start here, and then it moves towards the most open kind of attention or awareness. So at the most focused end, you're basically single-pointed on one thing, like the point of the tip of the finger that we talked about yesterday. And in that mode of attention, you're completely absorbed in that object, right? You're blocking everything out, and you're basically, well, the scientific term is you're upweighting those prediction errors. So you're basically blocking everything else out and you're saying, I only want that sensory data from whatever it is, a visual object, or, you know, it could be a mantra, or it could be the breath, depending on what the object of meditation is. And then the next type of awareness is flexible awareness, where you're noticing, so your attention is moving to whatever is capturing it, but it's open to do that. So in other words, imagine you're looking out the window and you, in the first example, you were just staring at a sign on the street, whereas now you're allowing your attention to move. So if there's a car going along the road, your attention will move to that. And then another car moves in another direction, your attention moves to that. And you're just kind of letting it go where it naturally moves on its own. Now moving kind of further along the spectrum, there's now open awareness where you're taking in the entire scene out the window at once. So you're looking out the window and you see all the cars moving and you see all the signs, you see all the buildings, and that's open awareness. And then at the furthest end of the spectrum is awareness of awareness. So now you're basically aware that you're looking out the window, and you're aware of your own consciousness. So that's kind of, you'll notice that there's these different modes of paying attention. And the value in having a flexible attention is that you're allowing the process of dependent origination to unfold on its own. So in the most focused type of attention, you're controlling your mind. You're trying to block everything out. And that prevents you from seeing things as they happen on their own. It's preventing you from seeing how the mind works on its own without interference. And so when you allow yourself to have a flexible attention and you're just aware of how mind's attention is moving, which is the definition of mindfulness, then you're gaining insight into why certain things capture your attention, or rather how that process unfolds. And that is the process of dependent origination that we'll go into more as the retreat unfolds. But you're just allowing yourself to see for yourself, all right, my mind is here, you know, with the food in my mouth. But now in the next moment, it's shifting to listening to the sound of the birds. And you're just watching how that happens. And there's nobody in control of it. It's just happening on its own.
Yeah. So as you exercise your ability to pay attention, you'll start to be able to have this full awareness. You'll be able to have a more open awareness. So you'll be able to actually listen to what I'm saying and even be able to pay attention to what's going on with the dogs barking. But you won't be distracted. In other words, when you are meditating, there is a tendency in the beginning for people to try very hard and push and become super focused on their object of meditation, to the point that when the pin drops, they get distracted and they get ousted from that meditation. They get shaken from it. And so that means that you're becoming super concentrated. But if you have that metacognition where you just observe how mind is meditating, observe the mind meditating, then whatever happens just passes right through you. Whether it's the dogs barking, whether it's the birds chirping, whether it's somebody opening the door, whether it's somebody closing the door, whether it's somebody sneezing, coughing, somebody, you know, is yawning very loudly, whatever it is, it just passes through the mind. It's just taken in as being arising based on causes and conditions. But your mind remains aware, staying with the object, orbiting around the object of meditation. And everything else in between is also seen. But that's no big deal. That's why I said, when you are meditating, you will have background thoughts, right? Thoughts in the background. That's okay. As long as you're staying with your object of meditation, that's fine. They will disappear on their own because they have lack of fuel. And that fuel is your attention. Your attention is key here. How do you pay attention? What do you pay attention to? And what is the degree of that attention? For an effective meditation, your attention should be flexible. Your attention should be able to move from one thing to the other very flexibly. And that flexibility is exercised and stretched through the process of using right effort, through the six R's. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, possesses mindfulness and full awareness, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw, Deer Park Institute. He resorts to a secluded resting place. On returning from his alms round, after his meal, He sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. What does that mean? Establishing mindfulness before him. Sometimes this has been interpreted as paying attention to what's in front of you. But really, it's just observing where your mind is in that moment. Understanding what the quality of your mind is. Is the mind constricted and tight? Is the mind loose and open? Where is your attention in that moment? If your attention is constricted, relax your attention. If your attention is too loose, start to bring in a little bit more focus. And then pay attention to where your intentions reside. For the more advanced practitioners, I will say that you can just sit down and observe where the intention is. Does it want to radiate loving kindness? Does it want to radiate compassion? Does it want to radiate equanimity? Or does it want to radiate joy? Or does it just want to stay in quiet mind? Observe the intention and allow the mind then to follow that intention and just observe how the mind does it. So, establishing mindfulness before you. Just sit down and have that attitude, right? Of let's see how this meditation goes. No expectations. Expectations are another word for craving. What are expectations, you said?
Expectations are dukkha under construction. It's one way to think about them.
And expectations are not meant to be met. Every time you have an expectation, either it's better than you expected or it's worse than you expected. It's rarely exactly what you expected. So let go of all expectations. Just be open and let the mind just do its thing. Treat the meditation like going to a movie theater, looking forward to seeing the movie. Watch what happens. Everything is fresh. Everything is new. Whatever arises, just observe it. Let it go if it distracts you and stay with your object of meditation. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with the mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with the mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. He is talking about the five hindrances here. Now, we're going to go a little more into detail about these hindrances and some of the antidotes that you can use for the hindrances. First of all, let's understand some of the causes and conditions for these hindrances. What I posit is that one of the things, or the way these hindrances arise, is because at some point you broke a precept. Now, that can't be all the time. And just because that has happened and a hindrance has arisen doesn't mean that you have to feel guilty that you broke a precept in the past. It's just being aware, okay, that was your intention before. Now you can purify your intention. So the way to understand it is when you indulge in breaking the first precept of harming and killing living beings, what kind of intention do you have there? There is an intention of ill will. There is an intention of aversion. And so thereby, it strengthens the hindrance of ill will and aversion. When you break the precept of taking what is not given, now that doesn't just mean stealing possessions. The way I would explain taking what is not given is taking another person's time more than that they have allotted for you, taking credit where credit is not due, expecting credit where credit is not due, taking attention away from someone when attention is due to them. These are different ways of taking what is not given. And what kind of mind or mindset indulges in that? A mind that is restless. And so the more you indulge in that, the more you strengthen the hindrance of restlessness. Breaking the third precept of sexual or sensual misconduct. Now, sexual misconduct here for the lay community is different than from the monastics. Obviously, monastics are celibate in the Theravada tradition and so on. But for the lay community, it's about being respectful to your life partner or partners, whoever they might be, whatever kind of relationship you have, whether it's a couple or a throuple or whatever it might be, being committed to them and not cheating on them. That's the understanding of not breaking the precept of sexual misconduct. Sensual misconduct, becoming so enamored by sensual experience that it causes you to break other precepts in the pursuit of that sensual desire. The intention behind that is sensual craving. So the more you indulge in that, the more you strengthen the hindrance of sensual craving. When you break the fourth precept of lying, gossiping, slandering, you cause doubt in yourself and in others. You think to yourself, if I can lie to others, others can lie to me. And you start doubting others. You start doubting yourself, and that translates into you doubting the practice, doubting your capabilities and capacities for the practice. Am I doing this right? I don't know if I heard that correctly. Am I staying with my object of meditation? Where am I in my meditation? All of these things are manifestations of doubt. But here also, the hindrance of doubt in particular, there is the fetter of doubt, which is the doubt of, or doubt in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But the fetter of doubt is being perplexed about what is wholesome and unwholesome. So what is wholesome and what is unwholesome? How do you recognize what is wholesome and how do you recognize what is unwholesome? Anything that causes tightness and tension in the mind and body, and anything that causes you and another harm, is unwholesome. But anything that creates openness and spaciousness in the mind, and anything that is beneficial for you and for the other, does not cause harm for you or for the other, that is wholesome. So, when you keep lying, when you indulge in gossip, what is gossip? You talk about another person behind their back. How do you know if you're gossiping about another person? If what you are going to say about that person when they are not in the room, if you can say that same thing about that person while they are in that room, then you're okay. But if you know if what you're going to say will hurt that person if they were in the room, then you're indulging in gossip and slander. So the more you indulge in that, the more doubt arises. And finally, indulging in intoxicants that dull the mind, that leads to sloth and torpor. Indulgence or overindulgence in anything, going back to consumption of media, consumption of anything, overconsumption of that, overindulgence in that causes a mind that's dull and tired. So the more you do that, the more sloth and torpor arises. And obviously, like I said, there are other causes and conditions. For example, if you have too much coffee in the morning, you'll feel anxious and you'll have restlessness. If you haven't had enough sleep, you'll have dullness of mind and you'll feel tired and so on. So, but what I am saying here is that there is a karmic understanding behind why the hindrances arise or how the hindrances arise. And they can be karmically understood as at some point in your life or in your past lives, you broke a precept. Now, how do you deal with the hindrances? You deal with them using the six R's, right? The six R's. But the Buddha also talked about the seven enlightenment factors, seven awakening factors. These are mindfulness, investigation of states, energy, joy, tranquility, collectedness, and equanimity. These are the antidotes for the different hindrances. For example, when we talk about sensual craving, what could be an antidote for sensual craving? The joy you feel mentally. Because the more you feel joyful, that's the whole thing about jhanas, that's the whole thing about super mundane states. You replace one type of joy for a higher kind of pleasure. So you replace sensual pleasure with mental pleasure, which is conceived through the practice of jhanas. So the joy that you feel, the piti, that is the factor of the first and second jhana, that can be utilized as an antidote for sensual craving, but also equanimity, because the mind can become agitated, for example. What about aversion? Loving kindness is the best antidote for aversion. But you can also use equanimity again. What about sloth and torpor? Sloth and torpor is because your attention becomes too loose. It's not focused enough because you don't have enough energy in the mind and body. So you utilize the enlightenment factor of energy. And that is predicated upon using the six R's, right effort, which balances that energy. And then we have restlessness. What about restlessness? Restlessness means that the mind is pushing too much. It means the mind is trying too hard. And you can see that when there's a certain kind of ring of tension around the head. And also lots of thoughts and lots of ideas manifesting in the mind. So the antidote for restlessness would be tranquility. Relax the mind. Pull your attention back a little bit. What about doubt? How do you let go of doubt? It's known as investigation of states. The antidote for that is investigation of states, dhamma vicheya. So dhamma vicheya doesn't mean that you need to intentionally analyze and reflect on what's going on. Insofar as understanding your mind is distracted and unwholesome is enough. And then bringing it back using the six R's. Is there any other hindrance I'm missing? I think I covered it all, right? Good. So you could use these different kinds of enlightenment factors individually when certain kinds of hindrances arise. Now, in the case of sloth and torpor, it says one becomes percipient of light. Percipient of light. Now, when the mind becomes too concentrated, there's a tendency for there to be light that arises in the mind. We don't necessarily want that. We don't want the mind to become too concentrated because then it can go into the field of restlessness. But here, the percipient of light can mean a couple of things. Number one, actual light, percipient of daylight, meditating in the daylight, meditating where there is a lot of light that prevents your mind from starting to fall asleep. But number two, we have to think about what this word light means. It comes from the word obhasa, in the Pali. And the Buddha talked about four kinds of obhasas, four kinds of light. There is the light of fire. Greater than that is the light of the moon. Greater than that is the light of the sun. And greater than that is the light of insight. So the light that we're talking about here is, yeah, we can use these different kinds of light, but the light of insight, which is dependent upon Dhamma Vicheya, investigating into what states are present and not present in the mind. But to simplify all of this and make it easy for you, I will say that the six R's already balance and activate the enlightenment factors automatically. How is that? When you recognize that you are distracted, what happens? You remember that you are now no longer on your object of meditation, which means you have sati. You have regained your mindfulness, your metacognition. Knowing that your mind is distracted means that you have investigation of states. In the same way that feeling and perception are intertwined, feeling being the experience, perception noting what that experience is, the mindfulness is knowing what is going on in the mind, and then the investigation of states is knowing the quality of that mind or mindset. When you release the attention from that distraction, you are utilizing right effort, which means you have proper energy, the enlightenment factor of energy. When you relax the tightness and tension in the mind, you bring up the tranquility factor. When you come back to the smile, you bring up the joy factor. And then when you return back to your object of meditation, you bring up the collectedness factor. And because you are 6R-ing without becoming tense about, without judging the hindrance or judging your own mind for being hindered and distracted, you are exercising equanimity. Equanimity, upeka. It is also understood as yata buddha jnana dasanam, which means the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Seeing things as they really are without getting affected one way or the other. Just seeing them plainly. This is upeka. This is equanimity. So when you 6R in this way, you are already cultivating that equanimity. So how do you let go of the hindrances? The utility of or the utilization of the enlightenment factors, but that can be simplified by just using right effort, using the 6Rs in this way, and then coming back to your object of meditation. So in the next passage, the Buddha talks about the jhanas, but I will skip that for now because tomorrow we will go in depth about the jhanas. So the Buddha says, "This is my instruction, Brahman, to those bhikkhus who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet attained the goal, who abide aspiring to the supreme security from bondage. But these things conduce both to a pleasant abiding here and now, and to mindfulness and full awareness for those bhikkhus who are arahats with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge." So in other words, you continue doing this until full awakening. And even after full awakening, you continue doing this because it's just pleasant. And that becomes the automated process of a fully awakened mind. When this was said, the Brahmin Ganaka Moglana asked the Blessed One, "When Master Gautama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, do they all attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, or do some not attain it?" That's a fair question. "When, Brahman, they are thus advised and instructed by me, some of my disciples attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it. Master Gautama, since Nibbana exists and the path leading to Nibbana exists, and Master Gautama is present as the guide. What is the cause and reason why, when Master Gautama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it? Another fair question. As to that, Brahman, I will ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Brahman? Are you familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha? Yes, Master Gautama, I am familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha. What do you think, Brahman? Suppose a man who came who wanted to go to Rajagaha, and he approached you and said, Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. Show me the road to Rajagaha. Then you told him, Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while, and you will see a certain village. Go a little further, and you will see a certain town. Go a little further, and you will see Rajagaha, having its lovely parks, groves, meadows, and ponds. Then, having been thus advised and instructed by you, he would take a wrong road and would go to the west. Then a second man came who wanted to go to Rajagaha, and he approached you and said, Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. Show me the road to Rajagaha. Then you told him, Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while, and you will see Rajagaha with its lovely parks, groves, meadows, and ponds. Then, having been advised and instructed by you, he would arrive safely in Rajagaha. Now, Brahman, since Rajagaha exists, and the path leading to Rajagaha exists, and you are present as the guide, what is the cause and reason why, when those men have been instructed and advised by you, one man takes a wrong road and goes to the west, and one arrives safely in Rajagaha? What can I say about that, Master Gautama? I am one who shows the way. So too, Brahman, Nibbana exists, and the path leading to Nibbana exists, and I am present as the guide. Yet when my disciples have been thus advised and instructed by me, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it. What can I do about that, Brahman? The Tathagat is one who shows the way. In other words, we can give you all of the instructions. We can tell you this is the path. We can give you the ins and outs of the instruction. But you have to walk the path. You have to apply the instructions and see for yourself. When this was said, the Brahmin Ganaka Moglana said to the Blessed One, There are persons who are faithless and have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, who are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, unguarded in their sense faculties, immoderate in eating, undevoted to wakefulness, unconcerned with recluseship, not greatly respectful of training, luxurious, careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, lazy, wanting in energy, unmindful, not fully aware, unconcentrated, with straying minds, devoid of wisdom, drivelers. Master Gautama does not dwell together with these. But there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, and loose-spoken, who are guarded in their sense faculties, moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, concerned with recluseship, greatly respectful of training, not luxurious or careless, who are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware and concentrated, with unified minds, possessing wisdom, not drivelers. Master Gautama dwells together with these. Just as black orris root is reckoned as the best of root perfumes, and red sandalwood is reckoned as the best of wood perfumes, and jasmine is reckoned as the best of flower perfumes, so too Master Gautama's advice is supreme among the teachings of today. Here he's talking about the six other contemporary teachings that were there around the time of the Buddha. We'll get into that later, but he's talking about how this is the best among those. Magnificent Master Gautama, magnificent Master Gautama. Master Gautama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overturned, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gautama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Let Master Gautama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life.